Peter is here, in my kitchen, cooking up a storm. I should probably take a moment to calm myself, but I don't want all that delicious food to get cold. After all, my fiancé made it for me. My stomach flips, my heart rate accelerating further, and I force myself to take deep breaths as I towel off and put the robe back on. Then, squaring my shoulders, I head back into the kitchen. Chapter 47 Sarah.
What time do you have to be at work?
Peter asks, serving me an artfully arranged plate of vegetable omelette with strips of bacon and a side of pancakes. I glance up at the clock on the wall. In about 40 minutes. I'm lucky I woke up when I did, because I completely spaced out on the alarm last night. I'm probably spacing out on something right now, because even though I'm outwardly calm, on the inside, I'm a hyperventilating mess. Peter is here. He's here, and we're engaged.
I'll walk you to your office, he says,
sitting down across from me with his own plate.
Unless you're taking the car.
I cautiously spear a piece of pancake with my fork. I was planning to go from there straight to the clinic, so, yeah. He doesn't blink.
Okay, I'll ride with you, and then go grocery shopping. Your fridge is nearly empty. How late are you going to be at the clinic?
He begins consuming his omelette with obvious hunger. I'm scheduled to be there until 10, but if there's any kind of an emergency, I might end up staying later, I say, watching him warily. Is he going to object? Try to control this portion of my life? George was understanding about my long hours, as he often worked late himself and had to travel a lot for work. But I don't know how Peter feels about it. He didn't stop me from working a lot before, but that was different. Back then, he was just biding his time before stealing me away.
Okay, I'll pick you up there.
He gets up and walks over to the counter, where my handbag is sitting. Reaching in, he fishes out my phone and starts typing on it. What are you doing? I ask, puzzled.
Giving you my number.
Finishing his task, he slips my phone back into my bag and returns to the table.
So you can call me when you're close to being done at the clinic. I don't want you in that area alone at night.
You're not having me watched anymore?
I am, but they keep their distance, and I won't.
He cuts into a piece of bacon, then looks up.
It's for your safety, Petichka.
His voice is soft, but firm, utterly inflexible. He's not going to compromise on this, and for some reason, I'm okay with that. Instead of making me feel restrained and controlled, his pathological need to protect me fills me with a kind of bubbly warmth. I'll never forget how it felt when the two meth heads tried to rob me by the clinic, and as traumatic as it was when Peter killed them, in hindsight, I'm grateful he was there. Besides, are you expecting any trouble? I ask, as the thought pops into my head. I mean, you must have quite a few enemies, with your former profession and all. He puts down his fork and meets my gaze.
It's always a possibility, Petichka. I can't lie. That's why I'm not going to take the security team off you. And why I created a new identity before coming here. I didn't want anyone in my former life to connect Peter Guerin in the suburbs of Chicago with Peter Sokolov, the assassin. In fact, part of the deal I made with the authorities is that Peter Sokolov no longer exists. He's listed as deceased in FBI, CIA, and Interpol records, as are Jan and Ilya Ivanov and Anton Rezov. The amnesty deal itself is highly classified, with only a few high-ranking individuals in the FBI and CIA privy to all the terms. The rest, like Agent Ryson, were told to just back off and keep their mouths shut. Of course, Esguerra and Kent know who I am, and there's always a chance I'll be spotted and identified by a former client or some such. However, unlike my name, my face wasn't widely known, and in any case, The chance of a random encounter with someone from my former life is small, especially in this part of the world.
Oh, wow. Until this moment, I didn't realize the full scope of the impossible deal he made. How did you get them to agree to all this? I mean, I know you said this as Guerra has leverage, but...
I trail off, as Peter's expression noticeably darkens.
Your government had conditions of their own for me, he says tightly. But it's nothing that needs to concern you, Petichka. Suffice it to say, the U.S. military is one of Esguera's biggest clients, and they want to maintain that amicable relationship, both because they want the weapons he produces, and because they want to keep those weapons out of others' hands.
By buying them up themselves?
Peter nods and resumes eating.
Exactly.
There's a grim edge to his expression, and as much as I want to pry further, I know I need to back off. Watching him finish his food, I have the unsettling sensation that a wild animal has invaded my cramped kitchen, a predator who belongs out in the jungle. I've seen him in domestic settings before, of course, but it feels different this time, knowing that he's here for good, that this big, lethal man is going to be part of my regular life. Part of my family. My mind starts to spin again, and I push my nearly empty plate away.
Peter, how is this going to work?
At his questioning look, I clarify. What am I going to tell my parents? The FBI probably showed them your picture at some point. Even if I introduce you as Peter Guerin, they're bound to suspect who you really are. Especially since I kept insisting that you'll be back when the misunderstanding with the FBI is resolved. The grim look leaves his face, replaced by one of dark amusement.
Well, that's just perfect then, isn't it?
Reaching across the table, he covers my hand with his palm.
You'll just tell them that the misunderstanding finally got resolved, and that I got a new last name in the process.
Uh-huh. And what about their friends? Who've heard a version of that same story. And what about my friends, who were told a completely different version, one in which you're nothing more than my kidnapper? What are they all going to think when I show up with this?
I lift my left hand, displaying my ring, out of the blue, and introduce a Russian fiancé named Peter, who looks suspiciously like a picture FBI agents might have been passing around when I disappeared.
He squeezes my hand. Don't worry about them, Petichka. Their opinions don't matter. Just tell them I'm someone you've been secretly dating for a few months, and let them draw their own conclusions.
What conclusions? That I'm fucked in the head? Or that I have a fetish for Russian men who share the same darkly handsome looks, and happen to be named Peter?
He grins and gets up, picking up his plate and mine.
Either way works. Just don't confirm anything. Let them think I'm in some kind of witness protection program, and you can't really talk about it.
That's actually not a bad idea. Marcia, and anyone else who suspects Peter's real identity, will think I'm completely nuts. But as long as I don't confirm their suspicions, there will be room for doubt. After all, how crazy is it that the man who murdered George and kidnapped me got full amnesty and is now about to marry me? My friends might as well think I've got some kind of masochistic tendencies, and have decided to hook up with a man who shares many of my tormentor's traits. It's certainly a simpler explanation.
So we tell my parents the truth, and stick to the Peter Guerin story with everyone else, I say, getting up to help him clear the table.
That's what makes sense to me,
he says, and glances at the clock.
You should get dressed and going, Petichka. You don't want to be late.
Right. For my job. I almost forgot about that.
Here, let me help you, I say, walking over to put away the leftovers, but he waves me away.
I've got it. Don't worry. Just go get ready for work.
And dropping a quick kiss on my forehead, he starts loading the dishwasher.
Chapter 48, Peter. I drive Sarah to her office and leave the car with her, so she can go to the clinic after work as planned. It's only a 10-minute walk from her office to her apartment building, and the grocery store is on the way, so I stop by and load up on the basics for tonight's dinner. It's not a lot, only what I can easily carry in one hand. I like my gun hand always free. And I make a mental note that we'll need a second car, just like everyone in the suburbs. That's not the only thing we'll need either. The fridge in Sarah's tiny kitchen is only a meter tall, and the kitchen itself is barely usable. I spent my formative years in a freezing, crumbling cell in Siberia, so I'm not picky about living quarters, but I see no reason for us to continue with an apartment that was clearly designed for a single occupant. Tonight, when Sarah returns, we'll discuss living arrangements, as well as our upcoming wedding on Saturday. Of course, I know why cars, apartments, and wedding details are on my mind. Thinking about logistics is distracting me from the urge to grab Sarah and lock her in my bedroom so I can fuck her all day long, and then all night, and then for a week after that. In fact, I want to chain her to my bed and always keep her there. I don't know what I expected when I returned, but it wasn't this. I didn't expect it to be so hard for me to let Sarah go about her routine, to go back to the way we lived before Japan. Back then, I also wanted her with me all the time, but letting her leave for work didn't tear me apart like this, didn't activate this maddening need to cage her and throw away the key. It was all I could do to act normally this morning, to kiss her on the forehead and drop her off at the office like a good husband-to-be, instead of a savage who wants nothing more than to cart her away to his cave. It's the one variable I didn't account for in my planning. My intensifying obsession with Sarah, the one thing that can fuck it all up. I'm hoping it's a temporary situation, that I'm feeling this way because we've just spent 9 months apart and I've missed her so intensely. That over time, as the memory of those hellish months fades, separating from her for a few hours will get better, easier, less like torture. The other possibility, that in Japan I got used to having Sarah with me 24/7 and may not be able to readjust to the old routine, is infinitely worse. The reason why I did all this was to make Sarah happy, to give her the ability to retain her career, her relationships with her family and friends. It was impossible when I was a fugitive, but now I can be a part of her life without taking it all away from her. I can give her everything, if only I can overcome my selfish need to keep her to myself.
Chapter 49. Sarah. I spend the majority of my workday oscillating between heart-pounding joy and spurts of panic. Peter is alive. He's back, and we're together. Without me getting kidnapped, no less. Despite what Peter said about his deal, I half expect the FBI to show up and charge me with aiding and abetting. Nobody comes, however. Everything is normal. Or as normal as can be when one is engaged to a former assassin. I'm not ready to answer my coworker's questions, so I hid my hand in my pocket and took off the ring as soon as I had a moment of privacy. Now the huge diamond is sitting at the bottom of my handbag, forcing me to carry the bag with me everywhere. I don't know how much the ring cost, but I suspect it was well into six figures. Did Peter buy or steal it? It's probably the former. He's rich enough to afford it, but I'll ask to be sure. I doubt he'll be offended. He's done much worse, that's for certain. That I'm even thinking about that? Wondering if my millionaire fiancé could have stolen my engagement ring, would have given any normal person pause. However, I'm no longer in the normal camp. Compared to killing my husband, a diamond heist is nothing more than a misdemeanor, one for which I can easily forgive Peter. In general, now that I've had time to recover from the shock of his arrival, the sporadic panic assailing me at the thought of marrying him is less intense, almost manageable. Toward the evening, as I get in the car to drive to the clinic, I even start thinking that we could visit my parents this weekend, and, depending on their reaction, tell them that we're getting married soon. Maybe as soon as this winter.
My heart starts racing again, and I have to take calming breaths before getting out of the car. No, winter is definitely too soon. There's too much to plan in such a short span of time. Next spring would be better. Maybe even next summer. A summer wedding is always in fashion. Yes, that's it, I decide, walking into the clinic. A year-long engagement would be perfect. We'd have a chance to acclimate to each other, settle into a regular life together. I have no idea if Peter is even capable of living like this, without the adrenaline and danger of his missions. He admitted to me once that he likes killing, but he enjoys the power and control that comes along with dealing death. Addictive, he called it, and I knew then that he'd never give it up. That the darkness is a part of him, one that can never be erased. Except he did give it up for me. He quit his job, he said. I haven't had a chance to question him about that, but there's only one way to interpret what he said. He's going straight. For me. So I wouldn't have to give up everything for him. My eyes prickle, and it's all I can do to smile and wave at Lydia as I hurry into the room where the patient is already waiting for me. She's a 16-year-old girl, here with her mom for her first pap smear, and I force myself to push my emotions aside and focus, to give the patient the attention she deserves. Fortunately, her exam shows nothing untoward, though when the mom leaves the room, the girl admits to having been sexually active since last year. I surreptitiously give her a box of condoms, and when the mom returns, I recommend an IUD to regulate the daughter's painful periods and provide protection against unplanned pregnancy in case she does become sexually active in the future. My daughter ain't no slut! The woman snaps and drags the girl away, making me glad I at least gave her daughter those condoms. Parents like that can be their kids' worst enemies. My next patient is a pregnant woman in her 30s. She has a history of miscarriages and no health insurance. After her, I see another teenage girl. She turns out to have chlamydia. And then it's time for my last patient. Finally. For the first time in forever, I'm eager to go home. Getting out my phone, I look up Peter's new number. Peter Guerin, it says in my contacts. And text him that I'll be ready to leave in about 20 minutes. In case he wants to meet me at the clinic. I don't know how exactly he'd do that, since I'm the one with the car, but knowing Peter, he'll manage. Putting the phone away, I stick my head out of the exam room and tell Lydia I'm ready for the next patient. I'm jotting down a few notes about the girl with chlamydia when the door opens and the last patient walks in. I look up and freeze in shock. I recognize this girl. It's Monica Jackson. The 17-year-old I helped after her stepfather raped her. Her small, round face is covered with purplish bruises, and one corner of her puffy lips is crusted with blood. "Hi, Dr. Kabakis," she says tremulously, and before I can answer, she breaks down crying. It takes me a solid 15 minutes to calm her down and learn that the stepfather got out of jail last week. "He was supposed to be away for 7 years. She tells me, her voice shaking. "And we were doing so, so well. With the money you gave us, we got a new place. I graduated and have been working full-time, and Bobby, that's my baby brother, he started school, a really good one, where they have computers and everything. And Mom, she was doing better too, only drinking a little in the morning. I thought we finally had our shit together, and then he got out on a technicality and..." She starts crying again, and I wait until she calms a little before asking carefully, "Did he do this to you? Did he hurt you?" She nods, wiping the tears off her face with one small fist. "Mom went on a drinking binge as soon as she heard he's out, and when I came home the day before yesterday, he was there, home with her, drinking together like old times. I got into an argument with him, told him to get out, and then he..." She breaks off, her shoulders beginning to shake again. It takes all my training to maintain a physician's required distance, instead of hugging her. "Did you report this to the police?" I ask gently, when she regains some composure, and she shakes her head, looking down at the floor. "He said he'll sue Mom for custody of Bobby if I say anything, and he's got connections now. That's how he got out early. Some drug dealer friend of his pulled some strings. Even if he does sue, that doesn't mean he'll win, I say. But Monica adamantly shakes her head again. He might not win, but he'll drag her through the mud, she says, looking up to meet my gaze. She's got priors, too, for public intoxication and prostitution, and child services is bound to get involved. I'm 18 now, so I could also sue for custody, but my job pays minimum wage, and there's no guarantee I'd win. And if I don't, Bobby will end up in a foster home. A fierce protectiveness kindles in her brown eyes. I can't let that happen, Dr. Kavakis. I've been through that, and I can't have that for my brother. He's got special needs. He won't survive this system. I can't take that risk, believe me. My heart breaks for her all over again. I still feel she should go to the police, but I can see I won't be able to convince her of that. And this time, I can't cut her a check and make it go away. $5,000 won't fix this, and I finally understand what it's like to hate someone enough to wish him dead. If a car hit her bastard of a stepfather tomorrow, I'd be the first to cheer. Swallowing my anger, I reach deep to find the distance necessary to do my job. Okay, Monica, I understand. Climb up on that table, please, and let's make sure you're not injured inside. She complies, wiping away the remnants of her tears, and I carefully examine her. Though the assault took place 2 days ago, there are still signs of vaginal bruising and tearing, so I collect a rape kit, just in case any DNA evidence remains, and she later changes her mind about going to the police. I also give her emergency contraception and check for STDs after she admits that her assailant didn't use a condom. Can you also please give me one of those copper things? She asks when I'm done. I don't want to get pregnant for a long time. Of course. She's 18, so it's easy. I schedule her for an IUD insertion next week to give her time to heal. Do you have some place to go? Other than your mom's place, I ask, as she prepares to leave. She better not be going home to her stepfather. I'm staying with a friend right now, she says, to my relief. He's got a couch I can crash on. What about your brother? Her narrow shoulders tense. There's no room for Bobby at my friend's place. I pick him up in the morning to take him to school, and then I bring him home. To your mom, who's drunk? Is your stepfather there when you return with Bobby? She looks away. I have to go, Dr. Kavakis. Thank you for everything. And before I can question her further, she hurries out of the room. Chapter 50. Sarah. I thought I did a good job fixing my smeared mascara before leaving the clinic, but as soon as I step outside and lay eyes on Peter's tall, broad-shouldered figure, the smile on his hard face disappears.
What's wrong?
He asks sharply, stepping forward to grip my hands.
Did someone hurt you?
I attempt a smile. No, of course not. Everything's fine. His eyes narrow dangerously.
Don't lie. You've been crying.
His gaze drops to my bare left hand.
Where is your ring?
I didn't want to have to explain. Despite my best efforts, my voice is overly thick, and I see his expression darken further.
Did someone say something?
He demands, and I shake my head, pulling my hands out of his grip and taking half a step back. No, it's nothing like that. I glance around us, but the street is dark and quiet, deserted except for an SUV idling by the curb on the other side. His ride, maybe? Looking up, I meet Peter's gaze. I just got upset over a patient, that's all. His harsh expression eases slightly.
I see. I'm sorry, Petichka. Did someone get hurt?
I swallow against a fresh influx of tears. It's a long story. Let's just go home. I start turning toward my parked car, but he catches my arm.
I'll have it taken home. Don't worry,
he says, and leads me toward the idling car. A black Mercedes SUV with suspiciously thick tinted windows. The driver rolls down his window as we approach.
Take her car home,
Peter orders, And a big, hard-looking man climbs out of the vehicle and hands over the keys to Peter. I blink as he walks by without so much as a nod to me. Is that
one of the security experts I've had watching you?
Yes.
Peter leads me around the car to the passenger side and opens the door for me, helping me climb inside before walking back to the driver's seat.
I've decided that instead of us getting another car, Danny will be your driver going forward,
he says, as he starts the car and pulls away from the curb.
I'll still pick you up most of the time, but if I can't get here in time, or you need to leave right away, I'll know you're safe regardless.
I open my mouth to argue, then stop. I don't have the energy for this right now. Not with my heart in pieces over Monica's tragic story. Not when I know that tomorrow morning, she'll be picking up her brother and confronting her assailant in the process.
What happened, Petichka?
Peter's big, warm palm covers my thigh, massaging the tense muscle before withdrawing.
What got you so upset?
I hesitate for a second, then capitulate. Who cares if Peter knows the whole story? So I tell him everything, from Monica's visit to the clinic before my kidnapping to what happened today. Peter listens expressionlessly until I finish. Then he asks softly,
So this girl is the reason you were assaulted by that Ellie that night?
I sit up straight, jolted by a sudden fear. It's not her fault. The last thing I need is for my overprotective assassin to blame Monica for the meth heads who tried to rob me.
Not saying that it is.
He pulls off the highway onto my exit and stops at a red light.
Just want to make sure I have all the facts.
My heart skips a beat. This is not going in the direction I expected. Why? I ask, staring at his hard profile. What do you need that for? He doesn't look at me.
Don't worry about it, my love. Your patient will be fine, I promise.
My mouth goes dry. Is he saying what I think he's saying? I didn't tell him Monica's name, but it wouldn't be hard for someone with Peter's knack of finding people to triangulate who she is. Peter? The light switches to green, and he presses on the gas, still not looking at me. My pulse speeds up further. Peter, please tell me you're not going to...
Going to what?
He turns onto my street.
I told you, you have nothing to worry about. She's going to be fine, this girl you helped. You don't need to worry about her.
She will be fine, but what about her stepfather? I want to ask, but I can't bring my mouth to form the words. If I say it out loud, it will make it real, instead of just a terrifying possibility in my mind. It will make me culpable. We pull into the parking lot of my building, and I exit the car before Peter has a chance to walk around and open the door for me. My heart is hammering in an audible rhythm, and my palms are sweating, even though I tell myself I'm likely misinterpreting the situation. Peter might just be soothing me, telling me what he thinks will calm me down. I want to believe it, and with any other man, I would believe it. If this were Joe Levinson, or any one of my bandmates, I'd take those words as nothing more than an empty reassurance, a kind of, there, there, all will be well. But this is Peter, and I can't make that kind of assumption. I have to...
When are we going to see your parents?
Peter asks, and I look up, startled, to find him standing next to me. Reaching over, he gathers my hand in his big palm and starts leading me toward the building, saying,
We need to discuss the arrangements for this Saturday with them.
I stare up at him in confusion. Did I already tell him about my idea of visiting my parents this weekend? But no, I just thought of that at work, and... This Saturday... He nods, glancing at me with a smile.
That's when I've booked everything for our wedding. We just need to discuss a few small details, and we're all set.
I stop in my tracks. What? Did he just say, our wedding? He releases my hand and turns to face me.
If you call them tonight, maybe we can have dinner with them tomorrow. That way, they'll have a chance to invite a few friends. And you can already talk to your co-workers and whoever else you want to be there. We should keep it small, for security reasons, but the venue will accommodate up to 100 people.
My tongue unglues from the roof of my mouth. You want us to marry this Saturday? As in, 3 days from now?
He tilts his head. Is that the problem? I wanted to do it sooner, but I figured the weekend is better than midweek, as far as getting your friends to attend.
I gape at him, feeling like I got hit by a freight train. Next year would be better, I finally manage. This weekend is just... it's impossible.
Why?
He takes my hand again and resumes walking, as though we're discussing what to eat for dinner and not our freaking wedding. A wedding he wants to have in 3 days. Because we can't. I scramble for ways to convince him. What about invitations? We don't have time to send them, and...
You can just call the people you want to invite. It's more personal like that anyway.
What about food? And photographers? And the dress?
All taken care of. I hired an excellent catering company, and a highly recommended florist. And the photographer is booked for all day Saturday, as is the videographer. For the dress, they're going to come to your office to measure you tomorrow, and you'll choose a design you like from their catalog. They promised me it won't take longer than a half hour, so you could do it on your lunch break. The hair and makeup people will come to our apartment first thing Saturday morning. And for the music, I hired the band that's currently on tour in Chicago. The C-Zone Boys, I believe they're called. I think I've heard you sing their songs.
If my jaw weren't attached, I'd be picking it up off the floor. He hired the C-Zone Boys for our impromptu wedding. As in, the band whose singles have been topping the charts for the past 2 years. Why not Rihanna or the Black Eyed Peas? I ask when I can speak again. And he shoots me a sidelong glance as we enter the lobby.
Is that what you want? I can see if we can...
No, I shake my head, unable to even find the words to explain. Never mind that. C-Zone is perfect. What's the venue?
It's Silver Lake Country Club, over in Orland Park. The weather is supposed to be perfect, so we'll have both the ceremony and the reception outdoors, right by the lake. Unless you want to take it inside, it's not too late to do that.
No, that's... The lakeside will work. He shepherds me into the elevator, and I numbly press the button for my floor, feeling like that freight train is dragging me along at madness-inducing speed. How could he have done all this? When? And why didn't he consult me? Is this what our life together is always going to be like? Before I tackle that thorny issue, I need to voice one last rational argument. What if no one comes? I ask, as we exit the elevator. It's already Wednesday. Most people have weekend plans, and...
They'll change them.
He reaches into his pocket and takes out a set of keys. A set he must have had made today, as I have mine in my bag. Opening the door, he lets me in and closes it behind us. I kick off my sandals. And if they can't?
Then they'll miss out.
He removes his own shoes and turns to face me.
Do you really care, Petichka? Your parents will be there, and so will you and I. Who else do you need?
No one. Not really. But that's not the point. Peter! I take a deep breath. I can't marry you this weekend. It's just too soon. His gaze hardens.
Too soon how? I told you, we have all the logistics covered.
It's not about the logistics. My voice spikes in volume, and I take another breath in an attempt to regain control. Striving for a calmer tone, I say, I haven't seen you for over 9 months, and before that, we didn't exactly have a normal relationship.
So what?
His eyes narrow.
We have that now.
You railroading me into marriage and making all the decisions about our wedding is not normal, Peter. Not by a long stretch. I'm proud of my composure so far. We need time to get to know each other in this context, to see if we can make this work. I trail off, seeing the storm gathering in the reflective silver of his gaze.
Why wouldn't we make it work?
His voice is dangerously low as he steps toward me.
This isn't a trial run, a wait-and-see college roommate situation. Do you really think that if we argue over dishes, I'm going to let you walk away?
My pulse spikes again. Of course he wouldn't. Not after everything he's done to get us here. Still, he has to realize that marrying me this weekend, and not giving me any choice about it, is not the way to go after a 9-month-long absence, preceded by a forced relationship involving murder, torture, and abduction. How about a winter wedding, I say in desperation. We could do it right around the December holidays, so the season will always be extra festive for us. We could plan a honeymoon around that time, too. I'll be able to take a week or two off work, and
we can do the honeymoon whenever.
Reaching for me, he slides his hands under my blouse, resting warm palms on my bare sides. His metallic eyes take on a heated gleam, as his thumbs rasp along the sensitive skin underneath my ribcage, stroking back and forth.
If you can't, or don't want to take time off next week, you don't have to. I'm okay with waiting until winter for the honeymoon.
Then why not the wedding? I hold his gaze, trying to focus on the topic at hand, instead of the way the slow, hypnotic stroking of those thumbs is heating up my skin and making my insides quiver. What harm will it do if we get married then, too? His mouth takes on a sensuous curve, and he bends his head, inhaling deeply, as if breathing in my scent.
You mean other than all my planning going to waste?
He murmurs, his lips brushing across the top of my ear. Yes. I close my eyes as he pulls me closer, nuzzling against the side of my neck as my head instinctively falls back, granting him better access. My breathing quickens, the melting sensation softening my bones, as the hard ridge of his arousal presses against my stomach, making me aware of an empty ache deep within.
Well,
he lightly bites my neck, then soothes the tiny sting by licking the wounded spot.
For one thing, I want you as my wife, and I want it today, not tomorrow or 3 days from now.
His mint-scented breath is warm on my skin, sending electric tingles down my body.
I want you to wear my ring at all times, everywhere, so everyone knows you're mine.
He places another biting lick behind my ear, his voice deepening further as he murmurs.
It's not rational, Petichka, but I need this. Need you. And I can't wait. Not after being apart from you for so long.
What about... It's getting harder to gather my thoughts as he continues to inflict those sensuous little bites all over my neck and shoulder juncture. With a monumental effort, I force myself to focus. What about kids? And where will we live? And what... I gasp as he undoes my zipper and slides his hand into my soaked panties. What about... I begin to pant as his fingers find my clit and start manipulating it with unerring skill. Your job.
I told you. I quit.
His breathing is just as ragged as mine as he sinks one long finger into me, then uses the resulting slickness to paint wet circles on my throbbing clit.
It's over.
But, oh, God. My hips are now shimmying in a circle, chasing after the movement of that teasing finger. The pressure is building inside me so rapidly, I can no longer form a single thought. Oh, God, Peter, I'm going to... With a choked cry, I explode, every muscle in my body clenching on a violent wave of pleasure. The orgasm is so strong that my mind goes blank, flooded with purely physical sensations. I'm dimly cognizant of being moved, of my pants and underwear being pushed down my legs. And then I'm bent over the sofa, and he's pushing into me, his big cock penetrating deep in one hard stroke. The shock of it jolts me to the bone, and my still quivering muscles lock tight, clamping in an instinctive effort to halt the invasion. But that only makes him feel thicker, more massive inside me, and I find myself panting again as he grips my hips and starts thrusting, his pelvis slamming against my ass with each merciless stroke.
Peter! I feel the wave gathering again, threatening to swamp me in white-hot bliss. Peter, wait! He doesn't slow down. If anything, his punishing thrusts speed up.
Come with me, he commands hoarsely. I want to feel you milk my cock.
I'm there before he finishes speaking, the wave cresting with tsunami-like force. The pleasure batters my senses, eviscerating the last shreds of my resistance. I don't know if I'm screaming, or if it's the blood roaring in my ears, but the rest of the sounds fade out. All I hear, all I feel, all I sense, is the ecstasy and him.
Chapter 51, Peter. My Petichka is quiet as I bring her to the bathroom and lower her into the bubble bath I prepared before leaving to pick her up. The tub is too small for us both, so I use the sink to wash up and then perch on the side of the tub, watching her rosy nipples play peekaboo with the bubbles. With her head resting on the edge of the tub, her eyes closed, and her delicate features pink with post-orgasmic glow, she looks so tempting I want her all over again. Tonight, I promise myself. As soon as Sarah is done with her bath, we're going to eat, and then she's mine all night long. Sensing my gaze on her, she opens her eyes.
Thank you for this, she murmurs, moving one graceful hand through the bubbles. I can't remember the last time I did this.
I fight the urge to reach in and capture that hand, to haul her against me so I can feel her bubble-slick body rubbing against mine. You're going to marry me on Saturday, I say, my tone harsher than I intended. That's non-negotiable. She visibly stiffens and sits up.
Peter, that's not...
Or it can be tonight. I'm not averse to flying to Vegas with you after dinner. I do my best to keep my eyes off the soft white breasts exposed above the water. This is too important to get distracted by my lust. As if sensing my thoughts, Sarah sinks back into the water, letting the bubbles shield those tempting breasts from view.
You have a plane on standby?
More or less. I let my teammates keep our plane for now, but I can charter a private jet on a couple of hours' notice. With enough money, anything is possible.
Peter...
She sits up again, this time covering her breasts with one slender arm.
We need to talk about this. About everything, really. You just came back yesterday, and I still don't really know where you've been or what you've been doing. Where are Anton and the twins? Are they here with you?
No. I take a deep breath and tamp down on the instinct that demands I carry her off to Vegas this very second. Sarah is right. There's a lot we haven't discussed. They're in Europe, but they'll fly in for our wedding, I explain and stand up. She follows my example, and I wrap a towel around her as she steps out of the tub. She looks impossibly small like this, with her head bent and the thick towel wrapped all around her slender body. It makes me aware of how defenseless she is, how breakable. Reminds me of how I once wanted to punish her, and how I still sometimes do. Let's eat and talk, I say, reining in the dark impulse. I'll tell you everything. None of it, though, will change what's about to happen. Before the end of this week, one way or another, Sarah will be my wife.
Chapter 52. Sarah. Our dinner tonight is a mix of Russian and Asian cuisine, with juicy pilmeni, Russian-style meat dumplings, served with sour cream as an appetizer, and a vegetable stir-fry topped with chili-marinated tofu as the main dish. Lunch was forever ago, and the bout of intense sex, combined with the hot bath, further depleted my stores of energy. I'm so ravenous that as soon as Peter sets the food on the table, I dig in, devouring 5 large dumplings and 2 servings of the spicy stir-fry before looking up from my plate. Hungry? Peter asks wryly as I go in for serving number 3, and I flush, Realizing I've been so focused on the food, I've barely said a word. This is really good, I say apologetically, and he grins. His metallic eyes as warm as I've ever seen them.
Enjoy, Petichka. I love seeing you eat the food I've made.
You're an amazing cook, I tell him sincerely, and his smile widens further.
I'm glad you think so, my love.
What if you open a restaurant? I ask impulsively. You know, like Yulia did, or a cafe of some kind? He laughs again, shaking his head.
No, Petichka, that's not for me. But I will feed you any time you want.
No, but seriously, what are you going to do here? I put down my fork and study him intensely. Do you have some ideas of what you'd like to do career-wise? You said you quit your job. I assume that means you're no longer, For some reason, the word sticks in my throat, and he lifts his eyebrows, looking deeply amused.
An assassin? No, Petichka. I'm done with that part of my life.
He spears a piece of bok choy with his fork.
I'm a law-abiding citizen going forward.
Really? I stare at him, both hopeful and disbelieving. I initially thought he might be going straight, but then we had that conversation about Monica. Does that mean I misunderstood? I could have sworn there was an implicit promise to do something to the stepfather. But if Peter says he's going legit, then maybe those were just empty, soothing words. The kind that any guy might say to calm his girlfriend. Thinking about Monica instantly sours my mood, killing what remained of my appetite, and I push my plate away as Peter grins and says,
Really? That's one of the conditions of the deal. No more crimes going forward.
Oh, good. His eyebrows lift again.
You don't sound too enthusiastic.
What? No. I force away the heavy feeling blanketing my chest at the thought of Monica and smile brightly. I'm ecstatic you're going straight. How could I not be? I mean it, too. Even if I have to squash that tiny kernel of guilt-tinged hope about a permanent solution for Monica's dilemma. There's no way I wanted that. I refuse to believe it.
I don't know, Petichka.
Peter cocks his head, regarding me thoughtfully.
Is there something that worries you about that?
Everything worries me, I say bluntly. How are you going to handle this kind of life? What are you going to do with your time? You say you want to marry me this Saturday, but then what? And what about your revenge? Did you find that last...
It's over.
His tone is bolt-cutter sharp, his face darkening abruptly.
There's nothing to discuss on that front.
I stare at him, the food I ate turning into a boulder in my stomach. What happened? He stands up and picks up his half-empty plate, then mine.
Nothing.
Striding to the sink, he deposits the dishes so hard they rattle, then returns to the table to get more. I get up too, my nerves strung tight as I watch him prowl around the kitchen with poorly controlled violence. Peter! Gathering my courage, I catch his wrist the next time he strides by me. What happened? I repeat softly, looking up to meet his steely gaze. The tendons in his thick wrist flex, and I know it would be child's play for him to break my grip.
Nothing,
he answers instead. And this time, I catch the undertone of bitter grief and rage.
Absolutely fucking nothing.
I dampen my dry lips. What does that mean? You didn't find him? His mouth twists, and he carefully extricates himself from my grip.
Let's just drop it, Petichka.
I want to, but I can't. Not if we're to build a life together. I won't marry another man whose secrets could destroy us. Please, Peter. I recapture his hand, squeezing it between my palms. Holding his gaze, I say quietly, Just tell me the truth. His fingers curl in my grasp, and he closes his eyes, breathing deeply. When he opens them, the bitter rage is gone, veiled by a lack of expression.
I told you, nothing happened,
he says evenly.
And nothing will. Henderson will go back to his regular life,
safe and sound, because that's part of the deal I made.
And as I stare at him, stunned, he says,
It's over, Sarah. There's nothing more to say.
I start to speak and stop, unable to come up with the right words. With any words, really. My heart feels like it's crumbling into pieces. My chest so tight I can't pull in a breath. He gave up a chance to fully avenge his family. For me. He did this all for me.
Don't,
he says tightly, and I realize I can feel a trickle of wetness on my face. The watery blur in front of my vision must be tears. I'm sorry. I let go of his hand and swipe the back of my hand across my cheeks. I'm just... It's fine. He stares at me, then turns away, resuming kitchen cleanup like nothing happened. Like he didn't just rip my heart out of my chest and put it in his pocket. I give myself a couple of minutes to calm down, and then I walk over to my bag and pick up my phone.
What are you doing?
Peter asks, as I press my parents' number, and I hold up my finger to my lips in a universal silencing gesture. Hi, Mom, I say when I hear the familiar hello. How are you? How are you feeling? I'm good, honey. She sounds puzzled. What's going on? Everything okay? I look up at the clock and wince when I see it's after 10. Yeah, everything is fine. Sorry to call so late. I had a shift at the clinic and lost track of time. I didn't wake you, did I? Me? Oh, no. I was just reading before bed. Your dad is already asleep, though. Did you want to talk to him? I can wake him up if you... No, no, it's fine. Let him sleep. I take a deep breath. Mom, what are you and Dad doing tomorrow night? Are you free for dinner? Out of the corner of my eye, I see Peter go still, then resume loading the dishwasher. Well, we were thinking of going to bingo night, but we don't have to, Mom says. Why, honey? You're not working tomorrow? I have a light schedule, I say, and it's almost true. I'm not on call tomorrow, nor do I have any surgical procedures. And as far as my clinic shift goes, I'll reschedule it for another day. Do you guys want to come over for dinner? A moment of silence, then... To your place? Yes. There's someone I'd like you to meet, I say, as Peter turns to look at me. This will only be the second time my parents visit my new apartment. I've never been particularly good at hosting, so usually I either come over to their house or we go out for lunch or brunch. With Peter in the picture, though, I figure it's best if we're at my place. My parents are more likely to be on their best behavior this way. Oh! Mom's voice fills with obvious excitement. Yes, of course, honey. We'd love to. Do you want us to bring anything, or will we order in? We got it, Mom. Don't worry about anything, I say, as Peter continues staring at me. See you tomorrow at 6, okay? I hang up, and he comes toward me. His movements slow and vaguely predatory, like the lazy stride of a jungle cat. That was my mom, I say, instinctively backing up. I invited them here for dinner tomorrow. You don't mind, do you? We can order in, or... My words end on a squeak as Peter picks me up and places me on the counter, then pulls apart my robe. Peter, wait! I lick my lips as he pushes the robe down my arms, burying me completely. We should decide what we're going to... Ah! I moan, my head falling back as he kisses the sensitive area around my collarbone, at the same time as his hand invades the aching nook between my legs, two rough fingers pushing into me without mercy. I'm not yet wet, and it hurts, yet my body clenches on a flash of heat, on a burst of violent sensation.
You're marrying me. This Saturday, he growls, fucking me with those fingers, and I moan my agreement, my body igniting anew. This Saturday? Tonight? Tomorrow? It doesn't matter anymore. I'm done fighting. Done resisting. He was right all along. I'm his, and he's mine. This was meant to be.
Chapter 53, Peter. She's sleeping, exhausted, when I carefully climb out of bed and gather the clothes I left folded on a chair. I dress quietly, taking care not to wake her, and then I pad out of the bedroom on sock-clad feet. My boots are by the entrance, so I pull them on and pat my jacket pocket to make sure my phone is there. I'll need it to navigate to the current location of one Mr. Samson Sonny Pearson, Monica Jackson's stepfather. Danny is already waiting for me in the parking lot, so I pull up the email from my hackers and give him an address a few blocks away from where Pearson lives, which happens to be at his ex-wife's apartment. Monica's mother clearly has no qualms about letting her daughter's rapist crash with her. It's a risk I'm taking, doing this myself. It would have been smarter to hire someone to carry out a discreet hit in a few months when no one could possibly connect Pearson's death to his stepdaughter's visit to the non-profit women's clinic. However, my Petichka was crying today. Crying because of this ubludak, and I can't let that stand. He's going to die tonight, and his stepdaughter will finally be free. Drop me off here, I tell Danny when we reach the address I gave him, a building that's a few blocks from my real destination. The guy is loyal and quite willing to operate outside the law, but I don't trust him like I do my own men. It's better if I do this alone, with no witnesses. Amira Pearson's apartment is on the second floor of a run-down four-story building. There is a faint smell of piss and vomit in the lobby, and the paint on the stairs is chipping, reminding me of Soviet-era buildings back in Russia. However, the apartment door I stop in front of is made of regular wood, not two layers of steel as is common in my corruption-ridden home country. I could break this door with a single kick if I were so inclined. I press my ear to the wood instead and listen. I can hear the low murmur of voices, so my information is correct. Sonny got the job unloading grocery store trucks at 3 a.m. and will be leaving for his shift shortly. I go back down and step outside to wait. I could have broken in while the fucker was sleeping, but Monica's mother and brother are in the apartment, so it's better to wait. It's better if I catch Sonny on his own and make it look like a robbery gone wrong. It's nearly a half hour before he comes out, but I stay sharp and alert, the adrenaline pumping steadily through my veins. I can't deny the dark anticipation I'm feeling, the bloodlust fueling me like jugs of coffee. I'm a predator, a monster, and I know it. Now Sonny Pearson will know it too. I stay half hidden in an alley, and as he passes by, I reach out and grab him by the front of his shirt, pulling him in. "Hey!" He tries to take a swing at me, but freezes as soon as I press my blade to his throat. "Don't move," I whisper, leaning in. "Don't even breathe." The Adam's apple in his thick neck bobs dangerously close to my blade.
What do you want, man? I ain't got no money.
I know. I don't have to see him blanch to know my smile is chilling. That's not what I'm after. And with that, I slice my blade across his throat. His warm blood bathes my fingers, and the stench of evacuating bowels fills the air. I watch the life fade from his mud-brown eyes, and then I say softly, "Monica sends her regards." Letting his body drop to the pavement, I wipe my hand and my blade on the cleanest part of his shirt, extract his wallet from his pocket, and step out of the alley heading back to where Danny is waiting. We'll have to stop by a motel on the way back. I need a shower before returning home.
Chapter 54. Sarah. I'm still not ready to openly wear my ring in the office, but at lunchtime, when the dress people, two stylish women about my age, show up, I lead them through the main lobby, ignoring the receptionist's curious stare. We go into one of the exam rooms, and they measure me from head to toe, a process that takes mere minutes with their skilled hands.
You're very slender, which is great, a tall, dark-haired woman, who introduced herself as Susie, says. We have a gorgeous Monique Lhuillier that will fit you with minimal alterations. Pam, do you have a picture?